Opinion's always been split on the longer effects of this pandemic. At home, there were the calls to open the borders. Remember those? Lest the cure be worse than the disease, and people internationally have held versions of that position. There are those who are baffled that we've shut society down in ways we haven't before, and equally there are those baffled and scornful of that position when they look at the human misery that's accrued in places like the US and Italy and Spain and Brazil. What people agree on is that whatever happens, it won't be business as usual again in the world. Perhaps ever again in some ways. But the shape of things to come is always an elusive outline to sketch. So we look to history. And this morning, a book called The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. Pandemics helped bring down the greatest human empire of all. Who knew? Can this be right? We thought it was soft living and tribes of Goths. Kyle Harper is Professor of Classics and Letters and Provost at the University of Oklahoma, and his books include Slavery in the Late Roman World as well. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Jim.
In your epilogue to this book, you know, you talk about the goddess Fortuna, and I notice online people have prescriptions for still invoking her even after 2,000 years. We've got a Fortuna buffet and restaurant not very far from where I'm sitting talking to you. But just broadly, Fortuna, who seems to regulate human activities to a remarkable degree, is not a kind goddess by and large, is she?
No, there's a reason why the Greeks and the Romans feared her.
Yes. And they had good reason to, judging by your book, especially the Romans. What the fall of Rome teaches us about the twin threats of lethal disease and ecological disaster. Well, we're right there, aren't we? I guess that's my first question.
Well, in some ways, we really are. And I think one of the things that I think we inevitably look to the past to understand is our own environmental predicament, climate change and pandemic disease. In the developed world, we've attained such a degree of control over infectious diseases. And that really does mark a fundamental difference with, say, ancient societies who didn't have germ theory or modern biomedicine, and so had very little means of controlling infectious diseases. And so pandemics could run almost unchecked. And we do live in a different world. But as we've been reminded, our control is certainly imperfect. And even in highly developed societies, we face very serious challenges from the goddess Fortuna and the unexpected changes that are inevitably a part of the natural world.
Yes, but you make the point, because we assume, and we're told actually, that the human-animal interface, for example, increasing our microbial contact, has been quite severe and alarming over the last few decades. But in fact, it was quite severe and alarming all those years ago. In fact, there was similar disturbance, similar encroachment on the natural world, and it all went on 2,000 years ago.
Right. When we domesticated animals, we changed our natural ecology. When we started living in cities, when we started building giant cities like Rome, which is probably the first human settlement to have more than 1 million people, that is a disease ecology. And so unintentionally and in many ways unpredictably, we provoke or create, however you want to put it, the infectious diseases that then come back to strike us. And so that's a very old pattern. And you certainly see it in the Roman imperial period, when the Roman Empire itself, the great cities, the systems of transportation, think about the Roman roads and the great networks of seaborne trade that characterized the Roman Empire, as well as kind of an early globalization. We tend to think of globalization as a modern phenomenon, and certainly it's something that's been accelerated in the age of air travel and integrated financial and labor and commodity markets. So globalization is accelerated, but it's something that's also got a deep past. And the Roman Empire is one of those periods in history that it really fosters greater connection with the world beyond. So they're trading extensively with sub-Saharan Africa, with the Near East, with China, with India. They have a huge consumer demand for spices and silks. And that kind of globalization brings challenges. That doesn't mean that it's bad, or certainly the challenges are insurmountable, but it creates an ecosystem for infectious diseases that ultimately contributes to some of the very serious challenges that the Roman Empire faces.
Yeah, okay, and I'll get back to their version of globalization. All right, so 1 million people, it was a giant city, 1 million people at various stages of its history in Rome itself, and at the peak of empire. We tend to forget, I think, how expansive that empire was, Kyle.
Yeah, it's one of the really amazing geographical feats in history, because this is a time period without any motorized transport. So they're reliant on sail, on horse travel, but no motorized transport and no telecommunication. So you send a letter, somebody has to carry it on horseback. And that creates tremendous challenges for connecting regions across space. The great historian Braudel once called distance the public enemy number one in the pre-modern world. And yet the Romans build this empire that covers this vast territory stretching from the northern reaches of the British Isles all the way to the Sahara. The Romans trade extensively with the Sahara, across the Sahara, and have military outposts really quite far south, deep into the Red Sea, far up the Nile, deep into the Near East, at times occupying what's now Iraq. So it's this vast empire, and at its height, probably 1 in 4 human beings alive live inside the Roman Empire.
And their view of the world, the classical view of the world then, incorporating the virtues and disciplines of Stoicism that's mentioned, that has redolence today as well, because the Romans, and I know this is a generalization, the Romans didn't see how their apple cart could be upset, just as 10 years ago, the New York Times was fond of talking about the end of war. I collect predictions, you see, I clipped that one up. And we all know, because we all know that war is silly, you know. If it weren't so serious, when we look at the US muscling up to China, we'd have a bit of a laugh about that. But the Romans didn't see this coming any more than we saw ours coming, yeah?
That's right. I forget the exact quote, but Camus says in The Plague something to the effect of war and plagues always surprise people, but there are always war and plagues. There's something in our psychology maybe that makes us want to forget the kind of catastrophes that inevitably are going to recur in human history. And the Romans combined that maybe natural human psychology with a kind of imperial arrogance. And certainly you try and empathize historically, but imagine that you were a citizen in the city of Rome itself. This is a society that was demilitarized at the center. And that in some ways is historically rare. The Romans were able to push out violence to the edges of the empire. And that gave them the sense that their empire was eternal, that they would rule forever. And of course, they ruled for an awfully long time. It is one of the most enduring political formations in history. But all things come to an end, including even the Roman Empire.
Yeah. So when did the pandemics come? How did they spread, and what did they do? They began with the Antonine Plague, I think.
Yeah, so pandemic diseases aren't a completely reliable, recurrent feature of human health. They have to have the right conditions in order to occur. And the Roman Empire creates those conditions because very clearly, almost out of the blue, in the 160s AD, which is during the reign of a Roman emperor named Marcus Aurelius, who's often considered one of the very capable Roman emperors. And at a time period when the Roman Empire is at its height, it's almost at its maximum territorial extent. It enjoys hegemony against its neighbors across virtually every frontier in the middle of the second century. This is what Edward Gibbon, the great English chronicler of the fall of the Roman Empire, called the happiest period in the history of humanity. Almost out of the blue, at this moment of peak population and prosperity and imperial power, the Roman Empire is struck by what is unmistakably a pandemic. It's a disease event that we first hear of outside the Roman Empire in Arabia, then in the Near East, in what's now Parthia, and then it spreads all across the Roman Empire. A disease event that was unlike anything any of them had ever seen. It was extremely lethal. It was terrifying for contemporaries. And of course, they didn't have the same kind of natural scientific framework for understanding disease that we have. So they explained it in terms of the god Apollo, who is the god of plague, and they thought that they had somehow angered Apollo. So the public response was very prominently organized around appeasing the god Apollo, which didn't seem to help. And the plague ravaged the Roman societies from one end of the empire to the other, east to west, south to north, and marks a real moment of change in the Roman Empire. And it's not the only factor, but it's certainly one of the really important ones in marking a transition from a period of Rome's dominance to a period when the Roman Empire, in many ways, will face graver challenges. It has much greater difficulty in fielding its massive army, in collecting its huge tax revenues, in controlling its frontiers. So it's not the moment the Roman Empire falls apart. And in some ways, it's a story of resilience, too, because the Romans endure the whipsaw of this great pandemic. But it is a subtle and profound moment of transformation.
And unlike Donald Trump, Marcus Aurelius falls back on his meditations, doesn't he? He becomes stoic about all this.
Yes. Well, he's one of the really interesting figures because we have his diary. It's not clear that he intended it ever for publication, but it's a marked contrast to certain national leaders. He's, like most high-class Romans, highly educated. So his diary is actually in Greek, although Latin would have been his day-to-day language. So he'd have been completely bilingual, highly educated in Stoic philosophy that is a philosophy, to oversimplify, of having a stiff upper lip, of repressing, we might put it, your emotions, and simply using your reason. It's a philosophy of, in some ways, of accepting your fate and realizing that many things are beyond your control and you shouldn't get worried or upset about things that are beyond your control. You can only control what you can control, and that's whether or not you do your duty. And so Marcus Aurelius lived through this terrible plague and watched many people that he knew personally suffer and die, and had a rather stoic attitude about it. And I think one of the reasons why he's often considered a good emperor is because he did help pull the Roman Empire through this challenge head on. He sold the palace treasures, supposedly, to help pay for the damages. And the Roman Empire did emerge.
How many politicians would do that today? The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. And Professor Kyle Harper is talking to us. All right, so in the middle of the 3rd century, by way of another pandemic example, came the plague of Cyprian. And that embedded Christianity, I think. So that had an enormous effect. Well, they all do, don't they? What do we think the plague of Cyprian was?
Well, that's a great question. It's a much more mysterious plague. We can at least speculate that the Antonine Plague in the 2nd century was smallpox, because we have a good description of its symptoms. With the Plague of Cyprian, which is a more mysterious disease event that hits the Romans in the 250s and 260s, we're on thinner ice. We don't really have the same level of description of what it was. We know that it was a terrifying disease that was highly lethal, that spread very quickly, that brought on fever, hemorrhaging. So the victims are described as ejecting blood from their face and vomiting blood. And this could suggest a kind of hemorrhagic fever, but there's other possibilities. So we don't know what it was. We would love to know. Certainly, I think I'd probably, more than anyone in the world, would love to know what pathogen caused the Plague of Cyprian.
Okay. So the Romans were encroaching on the natural world, unlocking its pestilences, just as we're doing right now. Climate change is the other aspect. And if we leave out anthropogenic exacerbation, you know, of climate change today, it occurred for the Romans. And, Kyle, they were lucky for a long time, just as we have arguably been lucky.
Right. It's a pre-industrial economy that's very exposed to climate variability and climate change. And just as you say, the Romans had a heck of a run of great luck that even the climate people, so I'm talking about the paleoclimatology literature, calls this long period of the history of the climate the Roman climate optimum. It's a period that's usually defined as the last 2 centuries BC and the first century or two AD. So it's the period when the Romans rise to power. And it's a period that's extraordinarily warm in the Northern Hemisphere, that was probably favorable to agriculturalists that are reliant on good climate, dependable rain. There's an element of sheer luck in what they accomplished, but it's also part of a bigger pattern. And this isn't the only case where the nature of climate variability and change has really affected the kind of outcomes of different human societies.
Yes, that's right. And we know what you're talking about in New Zealand because we're a pretty agricultural society again right now, actually, dependent on our agriculture at this time. So it's complicated, but climate waxed and waned in their favour. Globalisation, their version of it, and human overcrowding resulted in human catastrophe. What was the upshot? Because we care about the implications, don't we, of our pandemic now, even though it won't be the same, but some of the impulses will be. You must have been speculating about this quite a lot in recent months.
Right. Well, I've just learned that you're a collector of predictions, so I'm going to be very cautious. And historians usually make pretty bad futurists. But I actually think some of the best parallels with the COVID-19 pandemic are probably with the cholera pandemics of the 19th century that were really the quintessential pandemics of the 19th century world, which was an age of also very rapid globalization with steamships and railroads coming online. It was a period when Western societies had really started to control the worst epidemic mortality. So they had really learned to keep the bubonic plague and smallpox and typhus from spiraling completely out of control. And so the arrival of this new disease that came from the Ganges Delta in India and spread worldwide very quickly in waves, pandemic waves, were startling and global and had very different impacts in various societies, had very different impacts within societies. So very disproportionately impacted lower socioeconomic status people than wealthy people, that afflicted poor nations much more than wealthy nations. You know, that's an important parallel, and right on through the influenza pandemics of the 20th century, where there are a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. But you know, we should never be totally surprised by the outbreak of a pestilence. And I think we can understand our situation by trying to put it in comparison with the chronicles of plagues throughout the past.
Understand. And we understand, I think, that the glory of Rome carried with it the attainments of Rome, the seeds of its destruction. But is there a parallel today, a direct parallel? Because we've, as you say, have got the medicines and sophisticated health systems, and we've got the vaccines, although not yet for this one. We can combat diarrhea and dysentery and all that. Nevertheless, we still, and it's really useful that you point this out, because I think we've all tended to forget this. We live in a world that's microbial. You know, we're traveling along for the ride. The world belongs to them. That's my takeaway from your book. So what can we look forward to? You see, it seems to us that having read your book, those of us who have, that even with all our sophistication, we're in for a rough ride ahead, that there'll be major ruckuses and changes. All sorts of things might accrue as a result of the one we've got.
I think that's right. And I think one of the lessons from studying the history of pestilence is that these biological shocks are often major contributors to social crisis, reorganization, transformation. They act as a shock. They interrupt the course of ordinary events and sort of scramble the board that we're playing on. And so I think we went into this pandemic concerned about inequality within societies and between societies. And one of the really interesting, I think, features of this pandemic in the long run will be, how does it cause us to reflect upon and grapple with the challenges of inequalities? Because it's laying bare the kind of structural inequalities that we face, both in American society, where I am, or globally. And I think this will clearly be a catalytic moment. We've already seen that just think, to me, this is fascinating to watch as an ancient historian who studies pandemics. The coincidence of the pandemic with the racial protests and protests against racism in the United States, which have been this extraordinary sort of release of social and political energy that in some ways aren't caused by the pandemic, of course, right? It's not a virus that infects the respiratory tract that's causing people to go out into the streets and protest against racial inequality and police violence. And yet, clearly, somehow, there is this connection, right? I mean, it's not this issue didn't come out of nowhere, but it's been boiling for years. And it's the kind of overlap, the coincidence of this biological shock with this social tension that has created this very energetic, powerful moment in the United States that clearly is going to have longer term repercussions. It's not totally clear what they're going to be, but it's a pattern that I see as a historian, that you see these conjunctures, these moments where biological shock contributes to change in powerful yet unpredictable ways.
Yes, and a way that was totally accidental and yet doesn't seem accidental. And because on all those issues you've been mentioning, we were stymied for a long time, weren't we? And Gramsci famously said, the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And, you know, into this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. And we can look at the media-fed, admittedly, chaos in the world now and see a multiplicity of morbid symptoms. And Gramsci was also seeing a crisis of authority, wasn't he? And we can see that too. And we wonder how on earth it all plays out from here on in. And I guess historians don't know that, despite your knowledge, any more than we do.
No. You look at the crises the Roman went through. It was never just the plagues. It was when a plague aligned with a monetary crisis or a legitimacy crisis. And that's, you know, as a historian and a citizen, those are the kinds of things that do alarm me. What if we had a legitimacy crisis where the Constitution itself was really fundamentally challenged by if, say, the elections went awry or there was a refusal to hand over power? We think that's unthinkable, don't we?
But we can see where you're going with that one.
I hope it looks in retrospect, and maybe it will, but the Romans thought that these things were impossible too, and then they weren't.
Edward Gibbon, who you've mentioned in his History of Fall of the Decline of the Empire, concluded that Rome fell because of a kind of immoderate greatness. And the theory we've always kind of believed is that prosperity leads to softness and expansion leads to unwieldiness and collapse. And we assume all societies that last long enough have seen plagues. And as you say, Rome lasted through some of them, and it was just overreach in the end that did the Romans in. And you would argue, I'm sure, yourself for a multifactorial decline and fall. But do you think that pandemics were the instrument that fatally undermined Rome, most fatally?
I would defend that position. I mean, I think that because the Romans couldn't fund their armies, they had lost their military superiority, both numerically as well as strategically. You know, Roman power was extraordinary, but it was always, in some ways, fragile. The Romans could lose a battle here and there. They could, you know, have everybody has a bad day, but they were always sort of able to bounce back until they weren't. And so what are the deeper factors that meant that at various times the Roman Empire couldn't bounce back? And I think that the fiscal demographic base of the Roman Empire is submitted to these really powerful shocks where all of a sudden the population was undermined by the sudden massive loss of life. So it's not one thing, but I think we can look back on this history now and say, you know, it would have been very different. We look back at the story now and we can see that these giant biological shocks need to be written into the story.
In AD 400, we look at a very civilized city of 700,000 people with libraries and aqueducts and circuses for entertainment. And they had suburbs, really, didn't they? Areas and huge numbers of blocks of flats, all that stuff. Public toilets, baths, bakeries, brothels. And in 75 years, the barbarians would be at the gates, yeah? There was semblance of greatness, and it was gone very quickly.
It was gone very quickly in historical terms, in the blink of an eye. And the city of Rome itself is, of course, a kind of unusual creature that they thought was eternal. And This was a psychological shock when it was first sacked in 410. It was something like the shock of 9/11, of seeing the skyscrapers in New York attacked, that would have seemed surreal the day before, and then all of a sudden was a part of reality. It's still, by the standards of the 6th century, a large city, but then it's struck by another series of plagues that are demographically devastating, so that by, say, 600, so 2 centuries later, the city's probably not even home to 50,000 people. So it's a small town by our standards, where once there'd been a city of 1 million people, it must have felt, in huge quarters of it, almost empty.
Yeah. Now, it's a chilling prospect when we think back on the scope of its glory.
Maybe a silver lining is that this reminds us of our vulnerability and helps us develop forms of response and social capital that will make us more resilient in the face of what is inevitably the next one.
It's a big word, that maybe, but we all hope you're
maybe.
Right. lovely to talk to you. Professor Kyle Harper's been our guest. The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. This has been great fun. I appreciate being on.